Yeah, we're not going to do a long introduction. I'm just going to say hi. I'm Mary Davis, and Maria is on the other side of the screen there, and she has put together this wonderful presentation, and I'm here to kind of moderate and take questions, comments, things like that here at church. And we're going to talk about Japanese American incarceration during World War II, but also we're going to talk about the history of Japanese Americans and Japanese immigrants prior to their incarceration. So I'm going to turn it over to you, Maria.
All right. Awesome. Yeah, I'm meeting with you all today over Zoom as a member of St. Andrew's Racial Justice Group. Mary Davis and I are both members. My name is Maria Harwell. I use she, her pronouns. And I'm so honored and thankful that I've been given this opportunity to talk to you all today about this history of Japanese American incarceration during World War II. Starting off, we at St. Andrew's Lutheran Church acknowledge that in this space, we are on the traditional lands of the Duwamish and Coast Salish people, a people that are still here, continuing to honor and bring to light their ancestral heritage. Now, as a disclaimer, I want to be upfront and let you know I'm not an academic researcher or a history expert, just an amateur enthusiast about Japanese American history. And what I'm sharing with you all today is a combination of things that I've learned over the course of my own life as someone with Japanese heritage, and what I've learned from my time working at Uwajimaya, one of the last still operating Japanese-owned businesses from before the concentration camps happened. Also from the short but incredible time I spent volunteering at the Japanese Cultural and Community Center in Washington that's located in Seattle on Rainier Avenue. And I've also learned a lot from other excellent resources that we've provided a list for you all to check out. And also real quick before I start, I want to be clear about the words that I'm using in this presentation. There still remains some debate regarding the appropriate terminology to describe the Japanese American experience during World War II. So for this presentation, we're going to be using language set forth by Densho, which is Seattle's nonprofit dedicated to educating the public on Japanese American incarceration during the war. So the terminology used here from other quoted sources, it hasn't been altered. And you might have heard me use the word concentration camp, for example. We were taught to use internment camp growing up in school, but according to Densho, these camps were prison camps and they were outside the normal criminal justice system. They were designed to confine civilians for military or political purposes on the basis of race and ethnicity. So these relocation centers, internment camps, they fit the definition of concentration camps. So that is our preferred term for me. So that's what I'll be using for this presentation. So in terms of why I wanted to talk to you about this, I've got Japanese heritage myself. And I've known that, well, and starting off, my grandmother came to Japan after these camps ended. But all the same, anti-Asian racism still exists. I know, I've known this since I was a child. In fact, I have a personal anecdote to share. When I was in high school, I was learning about this subject in school. And I remember after the lesson ended, we had learned about how back then the racial slur Jap had been used by people. And one of my classmates turned to me and was like, "So does that mean you're a Jap?" And it's a moment like that, that just, what do you say? I was so put on the spot. I was so confused. And I think the thing to remark upon is the fact that I'm a quarter Japanese and I'm a quarter Norwegian. I sure have never been pointed out for my Norwegian side. I've only been pointed out for my Japanese side. So the other reasons I wanted to talk about this with you guys is that this part of US's history is treated as an open and shut case of war hysteria that started abruptly after Japan's attack on Pearl Harbor in 1941, when really it's a lot more complicated than that. And the other reason being because these camps because these camps happened, a lot of the Japanese American history was lost to time or destroyed. So to make sure that we're all on the same base, because not everyone learned about this in school, I found from talking to people, we're just going to cover the really big events and some basic terminology. So very simply, we start with December 7, 1941, the attack on Pearl Harbor. And with that, the U.S. goes from neutral during World War II to declaring war on Japan and its allies. And then 3 months later, on February 19th of 1942, so we're coming up against our 80th anniversary of this, Franklin D. Roosevelt signed Executive Order 9066, and that gave the Secretary of War the authority to prescribe military areas from which they may exclude any person. So that ended up being all of West Coast. And from there, they created the War Relocation Authority, WRA, and they evacuated, which was the government lingo for forcefully removed, over 120,000 people of Japanese ancestry and moved them into relocation centers, but they were concentration camps. And all of these people remained there for at least 3 years until the end of the war. So this is generally the sequence of events that most people were taught in school, if they were taught at all. So vocabulary to know. Issei is a Japanese word that refers to first generation Japanese Americans who immigrated to the U.S. They were born in Japan and they came here for a better life. These are the parents of the families that were in the camps, basically. And then Nisei, or second generation Japanese Americans, they were born here. And by being born here, their birthright is that they are American citizens. Whereas their parents, the Issei, did not have citizenship. In fact, federal law prohibited Asian immigrants from being naturalized citizens, all Asians. And then you have Nikkei. This is like a descriptor word. This is anyone of Japanese descent. So I'm Nikkei. You can use it to describe a community, the Nikkei community or Nikkei businesses. And then lastly, what we're going to learn a lot about today is Nihonmachi. These are Japan towns. So you've heard of the term Chinatown, probably. There's a lot of them around here. So back then, there were Japan towns, Nihonmachi. They were located in several major U.S. cities, including Seattle. And they were really everywhere. And then the camps happened. So instead of talking about the experience that these individuals had at the camps themselves, I want to talk about what caused it and what was lost. Based on what I've seen, it isn't overly difficult to find out what conditions were like at the concentration camps, or how people were treated, or how the community persevered in the face of blatant racially driven injustice. But the history of these camps is important to learn about in a different context. What did the camps destroy? Executive Order 9066 did not kill individuals. It killed a thriving economic community. It killed the American dream for entire generations, and it spat in the face of thousands of Japanese families who were proud of what they had built and the home that they had created with their own hands.
The videos are quieter than Maria's talking. So if you are at home, I would encourage you when we're playing a video to turn the volume up a little bit. We have turned the volume up here, but we're going to make sure we also have the subtitles going.
And then turn it back down at the end so that I'm not shouting in your ear. All right.
We all assembled down at the Pasadena Baywood Station. For me, it was very humiliating. I remember being on the train, and the train passes through Colorado Street because that's the main thoroughfare. I look out the street and I see my piano teacher waiting at the crossroads, or what you call it. And he's waiting for the train to pass. I didn't want him to see me because we were being carried out of Pasadena in a disgraceful way. I mean, we were being disgraced, actually. So I turned my head so he couldn't see me because I feel humiliated. having a bad day.
So that was a video of Elsie Uematsu Osajima. She was born in 1925, grew up in Pasadena, where her parents ran a small market, and then she and her family were forcefully removed to the Tulare Assembly Center in California, and then moved to the Gila River concentration camp in Arizona. All of these clips I'm going to be playing for you today are from densho.org. And I'll tell you more about that in just a bit. But in terms of this clip here, I just wanted to share that I remember growing up and I would hear about this humiliation of going to camp and the emotional toll of it. And it sounded awful, of course, but I didn't really understand, I think. It didn't quite sink in what that must have felt like. And it hasn't been until recent years that I've finally been able to understand. Before Pearl Harbor and Executive Order 9066, the Japanese community in America was bigger than I had ever imagined. And that's what I am desperate to convey to you all today. So this is what I was talking about, the densho.org website. This is the resource that we're going to use to dive into and uncover this history. This is the resource where I got the interview clips. And they're a nonprofit based in Seattle, Washington, and their mission is to archive historical documents, photographs, and interviews from those who live this history so those memories aren't lost. These are all interviews with Nisei. They were children and adolescents and young adults when the camps happened. And a lot of these interviews started being recorded in the 1990s and have been continued to be recorded and archived by Densho. So let's go back in time. I want you to rewind the clock in your mind and go back all the way back to the turn of the century. So we start with the Japanese immigration boom. Between 1890 and 1910, Seattle's population increased from 42,000 to nearly 240,000. And with Japan lifting its ban on emigration in 1885, the Seattle Japanese population rose from 125 to 6,127 over those same two decades. And it quickly became Seattle's largest immigration population. So the first waves of people looking for work, they were landing in Hawaii to work on the sugar plantations there. And then those people eventually decided to move to the mainland and make better money and start their families. We have a picture here. This is a family that is on their way to Seattle on the ship Seattle Maru from 1905. So, of course, there's a reaction when you have an immigration boom like this from the white community. So here we have a clip from the Seattle Times. Back then it was known as the Seattle Daily, from 1910. So 1910, 30 years before Pearl Harbor, right? Miller Freeman sees yellow peril ahead. Chief of Washington Naval Militia warns members to prepare for call to action, actual service against Japan. Men of Pacific Coast would bear the brunt. Yellow peril was a term used by anti-Japanese movement agitators in the early 1900s to describe the threat of Japanese immigration as a precursor to a Japanese invasion of the United States. And among the many groups and individuals who propagated the yellow peril myth were William Randolph Hearst's newspapers, which convinced many Californians during the early 1900s that a Japanese invasion was imminent. So as Japanese farmers were trying to build a new life in America, they faced racist anti-immigrant laws. Here's a clip I'm going to play. Go ahead and turn your volumes up at home.
Well, when Japanese early ones that decided to settle here, they were able to buy land. But when 1913 Alien Land Law, which stopped them from buying land, it was sort of a say the exact word I don't know, but they're up against the wall. Otherwise, they not able to buy land. As their children grew older, they bought land under the children's name, which the children were underage. And that's how some of the farmers was able to buy land. But otherwise, they didn't want the Japanese buying land. Well, the Indian land law affected us because my dad was not able to increase his holdings. Now that he's made a few dollars, he wants to expand, and it was impossible to expand. So only thing he did was that I leased property under my name, and that's how we farmed, large acreage. But we couldn't increase our acreage because I was a minor.
So that was H.E. Edward Sakaue, and he was born in 1912 in California, and he worked on his family's extensive farm holdings in San Jose, and then he and his family were forcefully removed to Heart Mountain concentration camp in Wyoming. These alien land laws that he's talking about, the very first of them started in California in 1913, and then more and more states adopted similar laws in the rest of the country. There were also more legislation in 1920s is when the U.S. Supreme Court put a ban on all further Japanese immigration. And if you, you know, and just like we said, like in the clip, if you don't have citizenship, you can't buy land. So they tried their best to get around that by leasing the farmland or by signing it under their children's name since they have citizenship. So we have some pictures here in 1919. This is from the Kumasaka family collection, and that's a farm in Washington State. And on the right, from the 1930s, a tomato farm. So people that were coming over from Japan found work in sawmills, on railroads, and they worked to turn stump lands into productive farms. And they developed these small but vibrant communities in Washington, like on Bainbridge and in Auburn and Seattle. And then here we've got some pictures from the urban centers. So as early as 1910, so this is a picture of an Issei man on the left on Second Avenue in Seattle. And on the right, we've got a picture of a street scene in Seattle showing a main jewelry company and H.S. Watanabe. Watanabe is a Japanese name. So by 1910, there were 70,000 Japanese and 3,000 Japanese-owned businesses in the United States. So that's a ratio of one business for every 22 people. There were hotels, restaurants, barber shops, pool rooms, tailors, and shoe shops. So this was Nihonmachi, and it represented a self-sustaining economic community. What I really like is this map that I found in Densho, and this shows you an entire stretch of Jackson Street in downtown Seattle. And every single one of these squares represents a Japanese business. This is a map from 1939. So restaurants, laundries, and other small businesses, they saw great success around the internet.
I don't know if everybody can see. This is Rainier. Over here, Rainier Avenue, and this is 12th Avenue, and that's Jackson.
So I compared it to the real life map, and I think this is actually south-north switched. But yeah, and this is before, there's a note that says this is before Boren Avenue was added in Seattle. So yeah, all businesses were Japanese-owned with the possible exception of the gasoline station by Rainier Avenue. So Seattle's pretty local, right? But we're going to get even more local than that. We're going to look at Bellevue next. So here we've got a picture of some children on a farm in Bellevue. Bellevue's primary strawberry growers were of Japanese descent. At the start of the war, there were 55 Japanese families with farms in Bellevue, a total of 472 acres of land. Now, here's the next video clip. This is Mitsuko Hashiguchi. She was born in 1921 in Bellevue, raised on a Bellevue farm, And then she and her family were incarcerated at Tule Lake concentration camp in California. And here she just talks about the daily chores that she had on the family farm.
My typical day was really rough sometime because I had to get up at 5 o'clock and help Dad with all the harvesting or anything that has to be done in the morning shift. I tried to get all that done for him as much as I can, being the oldest. And so I helped him and get things ready. And then I have to go to school at 8 o'clock, catch the bus and go to school. And then sometime I would walk home because faster than the bus make too many stops coming home. So that's the reason sometime I walked home and made a shortcut through every place and got home. And then that way I can help Dad more and on his job because he's got a lot to do. And a lot of time in tomato season, we had to sort all those red tomatoes in the greenhouses, and that's a night job. So we had to go get tomatoes sorted, packed, and everything at night job. Then I got my homework done at midnight. It's what I did, but I got it done. And my dad used to drive the horse in the middle of the night sometime. And I said, how can the horse see? He says, well, if the horse can see, I can see, so we can make it. So he used to cultivate the strawberries at pitch dark nights with a lantern hanging on the cultivator. But they had to be done for him to get all that work done.
So some of you might already know about the Bellevue Strawberry Festival, right? So according to an article by Heather Tricasas, who is the executive director of the Eastside Historical Society, the Strawberry Festival was regarded as an unqualified success the first year that it was held in 1925. It literally put Bellevue on the map. So here's a picture of a truck from back in, I think this is a picture from 1930 or so. Bellevue, the home of the strawberries. So this is a group photograph at the Bellevue Community Center dedication. So the Bellevue Community Center used to be located at Northeast 8th Street, just north of the current Bellevue Square Mall. This is from 1930. And just look at how big the Japanese American community was. So earlier in the century, Japanese immigrants, who were the first settlers of the Bellevue area, did the arduous and often dangerous task of removing immense tree stumps left behind from the logging of old growth firs. And along the challenges of clearing the land and intensive farming, the Nikkei often faced a hostile white community. Because in Bellevue, we had Miller Freeman, who was a publisher of multiple magazines and mentioned in that earlier news clip. This is according to a Seattle Times 2005 article written by David Takumi, who's the author of Divided Destiny, A History of Japanese Americans in Seattle. Quote, one of Bellevue's leading citizens, Miller Freeman, the developer of Bellevue Square, was a chief adversary. In a 1919 essay in the Seattle Star newspaper, Freeman bluntly asserted, I am for a white man's Pacific coast. Freeman and a host of other anti-Japanese agitators on the West Coast were relentless in their attacks and largely successful. The Immigration Act of 1924 cut off immigration from Japan. Washington State's 1921 alien land law forbade the sale of land to Japanese and other Asians. And here is a clip from Sumie Suguru Akizuki. She was born in 1929 in Bellevue, and she helped on her family's farm and was forcefully removed to Tule Lake concentration camp in California during the war, and then she returned back to Bellevue. And this is what she has to say about Miller Freeman.
Every person that you would talk to in of a Nikkei community would know that Miller Freeman was anti-Japanese. He was instrumental in getting that floating bridge across. And he was his son and grandson, developer of Bellevue Square, the Hyatt Regency, and just recently, his grandson published a book about the family. And he has, I think, about one or two pages about the Japanese people, about how his father respected the Japanese people. And I mean, it was not true, but in reading this book that the grandson wrote, It was just incredible to read that in 1980s, when they needed money for the Hyatt Regency, they sought out Japanese money. Which is Itochu, you've heard of Ito Company? It's one of the conglomerates of Japan. They provided a lot of the money because Japan was booming at that time. And I couldn't believe it when I think I lent you the book. So it shows a picture of the ribbon cutting of these Japanese representatives, and the wife is in the kimono. I thought, oh my goodness, if he only knew about the family and how much they hated the Japanese.
So all this is to say there was a lot of discrimination that existed prior to World War II. Now, I'm keeping my eye on the clock. It's already 9:30, so I think I might skip across some slides, if that's okay with you, Mary.
Yeah, because I want to make sure they can see the maps and stuff. So I don't.
Yeah, there's some really important maps at the end here. We've given you a sheet of paper, and it says densho.org for this website. I highly recommend everyone check it out because there are so many interviews that need to be checked out. So
if you need them, we got them here. And if you're at home, we'll link it when we put up the. I'll send it to Susan and. We can probably get it up with the recording.
Yep. So, of course, we finally come to Pearl Harbor, 1941, December 7th. So that was the end of 1941. In 1942, U.S. has to decide how they're going to respond to that. So one small response was that the Strawberry Festival was canceled in 1942. The Festival Association gave a variety of reasons, including a rationing of gasoline, a shortage of sugar, a conservation of tires, and the fact that the war effort was keeping so many workers busy. However, the real explanation was the internment of Japanese Americans in May of that year. That's also from Heather Triscasas. So the effects of this forced removal on the lives of the community were just devastating. Entire businesses and these families were all boarded up, abandoned, or vandalized. So everyone had to pack up. Some people were able to entrust their belongings with someone that they knew who wasn't going to camp, but no one really knew how long they were going to be gone for. So there's a really awesome map I want to share with you. Densho not only has interviews, but they have this fabulous interactive map. This is a screen cap of this interactive map, so it's just a still image. But if you go to the interactive map yourself, you can mess with all the settings that it has. What I'm showing you here is just one aspect of the map. So all of these lines are all converging in on one point. The point that it's converging in is one of the 10 concentration camps that the WRA set up. This is the Minidoka camp in Idaho. Minidoka was the camp that the most amount of Washingtonian Japanese Americans went to. So there's different colored lines. The yellow lines represent the movement from their homes to the camp before the camps. And then the blue lines represent leaving the camps and resettling. So you can see there's a lot of blue lines headed to the east. And there's, you know, people coming from the West Coast, of course. But when the yellow and the blue mix, that's basically supposed to represent that, you know, some amount of people went to the camps and some amount went back. Not necessarily the same people. But if you go to this interactive map yourself, you can zoom in on different areas. You can zoom all the way in on Seattle and Bellevue and the area around here. And from what I could tell, it seemed like Seattle had maybe 5,000 people go to Minidoka and maybe 2,200 people ended up going back to Seattle to resettle. So I highly recommend checking that out yourself.
You can hover over the spots. You can change the camp too. So
yep.
this one camp, you can change it to the other camps or select multiple. And they also have a option to select family. There are a few family stories of where they went to and where they left, after the war. So you can also go by family if you are that curious.
So I just want to end on two more clips, and then we'll be able to wrap things up. So after the war, some people did go back to the place that they came from. Not many did, but the people that did go back, it wasn't easy.
Well, it was a great shock. Couldn't believe it, how anything can be left like that for us to come home and face. It wasn't as hard for me as it was to my parents, because they were the one that had cleared the land, built up that land to make it to a farming ground, and they worked real, real hard on it. And so it really affected, I think, all the Issei's that had come back that way. All the windows were broken, every room, the wallpapers are torn, the linoleum was all pulled out in a mess. And of course the outside was, the weeds are about 6 feet tall, every piece of ground outside. And the greenhouse we had, all the glasses were all broken down and couldn't even use the greenhouse when we got home. And so it was nothing, and the well was of course full of garbage. Everything you can think of was in that well that we drank the water out of. So it took my brother and me about 3 days to clean up that mess completely out of the well, so that maybe we can use the water. And so we were kind of able to use the water. Before then, we had to haul all our water. We borrowed it from the service station that was down in Mid Lakes. So we took buckets, barrels, and everything, and got water from there for our daily use for three of us out there. The rest were in Seattle, so that helped a lot. So, but it was a terrific mess.
And then this is Frank Yamazaki. I didn't play his earlier clip, but he was raised in South Park in Seattle, born in 1923. And him and his family were incarcerated at Minidoka concentration camp, which you saw on the map in Idaho. And he was actually imprisoned at McNeil Island Penitentiary for refusing the draft during the war. And afterwards, he resettled back in Seattle after the war.
And I know my dad, he went back to this factory where he was a foreman for years and years. And now this little boy that he trained, you know, the boss's son is growing, and he was the one managing it. And I remember one day when he came home, his face is just like a sheet, white as a sheet. And the boss, apparently, you know, things have changed during that wartime, and they have a different manager and different way of operation. And I guess the boss says, Yama, you stay home, you know. He built the business for the company, you might say. And so when he was told to stay home, you know, it really killed him, you might say. And in this, you know, like a big fish in a small pond, he had certain respect, being the because a lot of the machine power workers were hired by him. They wanted Japanese employees, and so then he went to one of the semi relative or close friend who had a restaurant, and he went over there to wash dishes, you know. I saw him. It's just, he died. He was hurt, his pride and everything else.
So that's all the material that I prepared for today's presentation. I'd love to take any questions that anyone has, or if anyone's curious about how to learn more.
Well, we have the two, I'm going to show a couple books first.
Awesome.
So on this list that you have, there's a whole bunch of different, types of media that you can go look at, if you want to, learn more, explore more. I was going to talk a little bit about some books, because I know, a lot of us really like books as a way to access more knowledge. So Strawberry Days is the second book listed there. That's available. It looks like it's only an ebook right now, but it is available through the King County Library System. And that is about Bellevue. It's about the strawberry farmers in Bellevue. And a lot of the buildings that you probably frequent on a regular basis are sitting on strawberry field lands. Bell Square was built on top of strawberry fields, once owned by Japanese Americans. Microsoft used to be Strawberry Fields, things like that. And so there's that book. There is a graphic novel that George Takei wrote about his time in Japanese internment and also joining the war effort, because he was a soldier in the United States Army during that time, called They Called Us Enemy. This book, if you go and you look for it, I think it will normally say recommended for age 12 and up. I got to go to a book talk by George Takei on this book, and he said that's what the publishers put on it, but he would say that a 10-year-old could access the knowledge if you're sitting alongside them and reading it with them. And it, you know, it's comic book style. Very well done. And then there is one called Hotel on the Corner of Bitter and Sweet. And this is a novel, and it's talking about, Maria mentioned Japanese Americans needed to find somewhere to store their belongings if they wanted to try and keep them. And that's one part of this story. This does take place in Seattle. The Panama Hotel is still standing in Seattle somewhere. Yes. You said you've gone to it. Yeah. And so it is like a fiction. It's a historical fiction. So it's based on real life situations. I believe NPR a few years ago interviewed the author, so you could go look that up. So that's a couple of books that are out there. There's two different musical theater productions about Japanese internment that have been on Broadway. They're not currently running right now, but there's Making Tracks and Allegiance. And Allegiance was actually crowdfunded by efforts by George Takei. So it kind of pairs with this book a little bit. It's a very similar story to his story.
One book I could share about.
Oh, yeah. And
this one was referenced very often in my presentation. This is called Unsettled, Resettled, Seattle's Hunt Hotel, The Secret History of the Japanese Language School. This one is a very special book that I think you might only be able to get if you go in person to the Japanese Cultural Community Center in Washington. But it's basically about the history of that building. It starts out as a language school, and then everyone goes to camps. They come back, and it was turned into a hostel for Japanese American families trying to get their lives back. And now it is a museum and the place that I volunteered at.
Mary, can that information be accessed on the St. Andrews website,
Yes.
books and the other information?
Yes, we can make this look a little prettier before we put it up on the website. But yes, absolutely. We wanted to make sure that we had this for people who are here today. Yeah, absolutely. We'll make sure it's posted along with the video of today's presentation.
Thank you.
That this book, Hotel on the Corner of Bitter and Sweet. He said it's a good read. Anyone who's read this one has told me it's a good read. It is a New York Times bestseller for anyone who wants to take that and run with it. I was able to get this next day from Half Price. I ordered it online at Half Price Books, and they said they were surprised I had to order it online. I said, I just wanted to be sure you had it. They usually, Half Price Books has a lot of copies of these. You can get it new. The library had it checked out. The wait list was really long for it. So I'm assuming it's a good book.
And for clarification, it was Miller Freeman, who is the grandfather of Kemper Freeman Jr.
And that's right.
Who was the anti-Japanese.
Yeah.
Another good book is, of course, Snow Falling on Cedars. And that somewhat documents the Bainbridge Island people, who were the first ones out of Washington State to be relocated. And anybody here made the Owls trip? We went over to the National Monument, the Owls Group, that is over on Bainbridge. It's a national park. Go see it.
I have one thing to add. really fast, if that's okay.
Yeah, go.
I've realized, so there's an anniversary coming up. It's the 80th anniversary of the Executive Order 9066. I'm going to put a link in chat, and I hope we can make it available on the St. Andrews website. But Densho has put together a list of multiple events that are happening in our area. So, like, you can pick the one that you can hopefully go to. Some of them have already happened, I think.
It's on Densho's site.
Yeah, it's on Densho's site, and this is the exact, it's a really long URL, but there's multiple things happening right now to help people remember what happened for this 80th anniversary. It's a considered a day of remembrance is what it is. Yep. I still need to look at the exact information. I recommend everyone look it up yourselves, basically. There was a faculty member who essentially defaced an artist's installation at Bellevue College and tried to erase a portion of the, they didn't deface the artwork, but they erased a section of a description of an art installation about the incarceration of Japanese people. And they erased a sentence that was talking about Miller Freeman. And it, when something like that happens, it's so disturbing. I mean, it was one person, the person in my classroom who called me a Jap. It's one person. It's one thing. It really, it's, everyone talks about minor, what's it called? Microaggressions. Except in this case, this was a publicly available art installation that someone is trying to protect a legacy of what happened. And I think what's important is we need to be telling the truth about what happened. We need to be honest with the mistakes that we've made so that we can make a better place in the future. That's all I have to say about that.
One thing I'll add right before the end of this presentation is that I know at least the Bellevue School District has added more to their history curriculum, especially at the elementary age, starting with about third grade, teaching more about Japanese incarceration and the camps that they were at. The Bellevue School District currently at their district headquarters, which is across from the Botanical Gardens, has on display what their curriculum that they teach for third grade on up. So that's something that you can check out. I think they have it up this month. But it is something that schools, I know not just Bellevue School District, schools are working to provide more than what's been provided in the past, as far as learning about what was the Puyallup Fairgrounds before it was the fairgrounds. You know, Bellevue was strawberry fields that were owned by Japanese Americans and things like that, that I didn't even learn when I was in school. And that's, you know, pretty recent. So making sure that we are teaching that sort of history. All right. Well, thank you all for being here. That concludes our presentation.
Thank you so much. Please continue your research.
Have a great day.